Welcome to the Overdrive Outdoors Podcast,
your source for everything outdoors.
Let's kick it into overdrive.
Overdrive Outdoors Podcast, brought to you by Predator Hunter Outdoors. Whether you are new to predator hunting or looking to upgrade your equipment, Predator Hunter Outdoors will have you hunting after the sun goes down. Carrying a full line of lights, night vision, and thermal optics, along with tripods, calls, mounting systems, and more, check them out at www.predatorhunteroutdoors.com or on Facebook at Predator Hunter Outdoors. Use promo code OVERDRIVE2021 for 20% off your order. Want to lengthen your time in the field and shorten your scouting time? Not only does the HuntWise app show you property boundaries, landowners' names, and in some cases even their phone number, but using the app will show you the wind direction on the map of the place you want to hunt. And the HuntCast feature shows peak movement times for various species, including predators. Get the HuntWise app at www.huntwise.com, the Google Play Store, or the Apple App Store. For only $59.99 a year for Pro or $119.99 a year for Elite. Use promo code OVERDRIVE20 for 20% off an annual membership.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Overdrive Outdoors Podcast. This week, it's going to be hosted by Kevin Rott once again, and he's going to be talking to Buck Wells of Wyoming. Buck Wells, this is his second time on our podcast, and there's a reason for that. Buck is loaded with information on coyotes and coyote hunting. Why? He says because of the time he spends with the coyotes. Buck's been hunting them for a long time, has tons of information on vocals, on breeding season, what to do in certain situations. This episode's going to be great for the beginning coyote hunter. Myself, I've been doing it since I was 16. I'm 33 now, and I picked up on a lot of helpful information. So give this one a listen. We appreciate everybody who clicked play once again this week. Give it a like, a share, a follow, whatever you can do. We'd appreciate it very much. But without further ado, let's get into this overly informative episode with Buck Wells.
Good evening, everybody. Kevin Rott here with Overdrive Outdoors, and tonight we have special guest Buck Wells from Wyoming. How you doing tonight, Buck?
Good.
This isn't Buck's first rodeo with us. He's been on here before. Buck has been a great source of knowledge and information over the years that we've known him. We went out and hunted with him before, which hopefully we'll be doing again soon.
Yes.
And Buck probably knows more about coyotes and predators in general than I've forgotten. and, you know, how did you get all this knowledge, Buck?
Well, being out there with them is the majority of it.
Okay.
You know, it's just like if you hang around in the hen house long enough, you're going to figure out how they're laying eggs.
You know, that's an interesting point. Not about the hens and the eggs, because I like eggs. But there was recently a discussion going on, and I think it went back to it, and it was kind of some tree huggers, but they got on talking about this whole thing about if you shoot the male or if you shoot a female, it's going to cause them to go into heat and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And they cite all these different studies. Well, there's a book called Journals of a Coyotero from, I don't remember the guy's name, but I have his book around here somewhere. And that's one of the things he talks about is he referenced that study and basically felt that study was worthless and it was politically driven.
Yes.
And his comment was, I know about these animals because I've been out there with them.
Yes.
And he's one of those guys, I mean, that's how he made his living for, I mean, I think he was older than both of us. And that's how he made his living was pursuing predators for governments or private individuals or whatever. And he basically felt that those studies were I mean, for lack of a better term, worthless, and they were politically driven.
That one particular study was. It was, you know, funded pretty poorly. And the guy that surmised the whole scenario did a off-the-cuff assumption. Well, and it fed right to the greenies what they wanted to hear, that if your coyote population in an area drops because you've killed a coyote, then the coyote female is going to try and reproduce to fill that void. Well, that's not how anatomy works. Just right. Because, you know, there isn't enough coyotes in an area doesn't influence the female to create more. What is a bigger factor in that is her health, food supplies, deprivation, disease. All those things play a big part in how many coyotes are going to be in an area, far more than how many coyotes are actually there.
And see, you know, back in my formulative years of predator hunting, that's something that I believed back in that time. I mean, I know I told that to people, that coyotes have an ability that when population is low, the females will have higher litter sizes. And that's not necessarily the case, which I've learned. And between yourself and another gentleman, Ed Gajewski, who goes by Yotehead, he's another guy that I consider a really valuable source of information. The point was made, same as what you just said, in terms of like litter sizes, a lot of that is dependent on the health of the female coyotes and the age.
Yeah, age is a big one.
Younger coyotes will have bigger litters, correct?
Correct. Far younger, more healthy. So. Right. When they're still in their prime breeding years.
Yep.
The older the coyote gets, of course, just like, you know, most of our women, the older they get, the grouchier they get, and the less they want to breed.
She's not still
at least that's it. My take on it. So I've found your coyotes that breed the best numbers for pups are within the first 3 years.
Okay.
Once you get beyond that, then it kind of seems to, in my opinion, taper off.
Sure.
And in that one study that everybody, all these greenies cite, was debunked ages ago, but they didn't want to hear that. That's not what they wanted to hear.
Of course not. It doesn't fit their narrative.
Right.
So now, female coyotes are able to breed at under a year old, aren't they?
Well,
give or take. I mean,
I've never put a stopwatch on one. Generally, first season out, they'll breed, but they won't necessarily throw pups.
Okay.
You know, they'll go into heat.
Sure.
But they may not make pups.
Okay.
And some will. You know, right. I mean, that's, it's like the anything else on the farm. It's a hit and miss. First year out, it's always different.
Right. So now that leads to the next thing, which is a common thing I hear from people that don't know squat about coyotes. And it's funny because I hear it from some of the landowners where I hunt. Oh, they must have killed something. They were howling like crazy out there.
Oh.
And, you know, I try to explain to them that that's not an indication that they have a kill. It's a normal thing that coyotes do every evening, or, you know, depending on season and everything. And it's more or less, from what I understand, it's almost like they're taking a roll call. They howl to hear what other coyotes are in the area. So they howl and then wait for the responses.
You're on track there. The coyote is the most vocal predator on the planet. They're talking every night and every morning. Badgers don't do it. Wolves might do it, but bears don't do it. You know, they are the most vocal. But they use that howling for, like you say, taking a roll call and establishing their territory. It's theirs, their yard. You've heard me use that term.
Yep.
it's also a way to meet the neighbors. You get somebody new moved in, you kind of want to, you know, make your introductions. Well, that in a college world, that's what they're doing.
And now I've heard some people throw out a number, and I'm probably not saying the correct number, but I want to say it was 75 to 80% of the coyotes that you'll have or that you'll see are what they call transient coyotes, where coyotes move around a lot, especially this time of year during mating season. So a lot of the coyotes you may see when you go out hunting might not be there tomorrow. And they may have just came into that area, unless they're part of the coyotes that live in that area. But the bulk of them are what they call transient coyotes. They're just passing through.
Well, I don't know if it's that high a percentage. That varies.
That probably depends a lot on the overall population density.
Well, it depends a lot more on the carrying capacity of the land.
Okay.
If there's no food there, when they come through, they're not going to hang around or come back through again.
Right.
They're like me. They're always looking for the kitchen. And, you know, once they find the kitchen and nobody's running them off, that's kind of where they're going to hang out.
Right.
And that will vary throughout the year.
Yep.
There are times of the year.
And it's going to vary year to year as well.
Right.
And that's
season to season changes.
That's something that I've noticed. I think a lot of us have noticed too, guys that have spent a lot of time in the field, is you'll have particular properties that one year it's like you can throw a stick out there and you're going to be landing by a coyote. And then the next year you'll go out there and it's like you can't even buy one.
It's like God reached down and grabbed them and took off.
Yeah.
There ain't a coyote around.
Right. And then, you know, a year or two later, that area will be hot again. So I would assume a lot of that is, you know, probably like you said, that particular grounds having stuff to hold the coyotes, whether it be food, water, shelter.
Right. Coyotes migrate around quite a bit until they set up their home ground and get a mate. And then that turf at that point is theirs, and they'll have, you know, however many acres they need. And then around comes breeding season. Well, once the breeding season tapers off and then it starts to become denning season, that area shrinks. They're going to stay close to home in that den, especially when those pups are first born. They don't get too far from the den,
right?
Basically. So their core area shrinks to the point where they can cover it in half a day.
Mm-hmm.
We got coyotes out here. I've seen one. I want him bad. He's got a stripe. Runs right down both sides like a racing stripe.
Mm-hmm.
And if I can get him, I'm going to mount his little fanny. But he's one I can tell you where he's going to be every 3 days, and he's been there 2 years.
Really?
But where he's at the other 2 days, I couldn't tell you, because he's nowhere around that I can find. So his area must be pretty big.
Now around here, this is before I really got into coyote hunting. I remember a guy that I talked to that was a trapper, and he had told me, he says, on average, the coyotes around here will come through any given area once about every 10 to 14 days.
And I would say that's about right.
Yeah. Yep. And based on what I've seen trapping, because when I'm trapping, obviously I'm watching the sign, that seems to be pretty consistent. I mean, there's a little bit of variance in there, but every week, you know, to 10.
Week or two. Days, yeah.
Yep.
And we're still not talking about the travel corridors.
Right.
They get highways. Coyotes coming and going all the time, running between areas.
Yep.
You know, and those guys aren't necessarily migratory, but they kind of act that way.
Right.
That's just a whole different scenario.
There's a group. It's actually, I don't know who it's sponsored by or who they're funded by, but it's a educational group here in Michigan. And they used to go by the name of the Predator Prey Project. And they will They do several different things. They'll set out hair traps so they can get hair and check DNA of animals. Yep. They do scat analysis, and then they also collar a bunch of these animals, and they'll use GPS tracking and show where these animals travel. Now, recently they had one, I think we posted it on our page, one of their studies where they tracked a female coyote, and they showed her travel routes where she covered almost like half the state in the matter of like 3 days.
Oh, yeah.
And she went up there, she hung around there for however long it was, and then all of a sudden she came back to that area. She ended up getting hit by a car. But they use that data to show just how much she traveled. And it's interesting because when she traveled that roughly half that part of the state, it was almost like a beeline. She just went like almost straight north, got up to that northern part, went like east and west and a smaller area for however long it was, and then just got bored with it, whatever, and came back down south and walked in front of a car. So it's kind of interesting when you see those studies to actually see what the travel routes are, because they're the GPS collars that they use actually transmit their location, like, I don't know, like every half hour or something.
Yeah, sometimes quicker than that, even.
Yeah, so they actually get a pretty detailed amount of data showing, you know, where that animal traveled. So I like looking at stuff like that because it gives you more of a look into what these animals can do or will do.
Remind me, and I will send you a study done out of Yellowstone. They had 5 different packs, and they did basically the same thing. They collared a bunch of these coyotes and tracked them within their area.
Mm-hmm.
And they did this for like 2 years, and it showed the different core size changes.
Mm-hmm.
And then they managed to, I think, collar some pups, mm-hmm. and it showed how far the pups traveled.
Oh, really?
Once they were kicked out of the home front.
That would be real interesting to see.
It they've done so many studies out of Yellowstone on coyotes, it's ridiculous. But, you know, that's how those guys learn. They get paid government money to do it.
Right. Yeah, we pay them pretty well, too, probably.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, they do fine.
Well, let's move on to the next point. Right now, this time of year, I've heard conflicting things. Generally speaking, well, now we're into February, but generally speaking, I've heard that we're in mating season, which I think we're getting towards middle or tail end of it here, because I think we had some that were coming into heat kind of early this year. But that being said, I know I just seen a couple other people that were out more your way that said, yeah, we're definitely in mating season.
Yeah.
Is that what you would see right now?
Out here, yes. And I get a kick out of people. They say, whoa, breeding season is in January. January 1st on, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Well, no. It's just like any other dog. When that female gets close, she may come in early.
Okay.
In fact, there's a bunch of them out here that'll come in late if there's a big snowstorm. And that holds up the process, sets them back a week or two.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're weather dependent to a degree.
Okay.
So you can't set your stopwatch or your calendar and right. say, yes, on this date, they're going to breed. And on this date, they're going to throw pups.
Right.
That's not how it works.
Okay. Well, that makes sense. I mean, I think you see something similar with a rut. I mean, general time frame, yep. you can say, okay, approximately this time frame, but you can't nail it down to, you know, no. a specific date or moon phase or anything like that.
My great uncle, which is kind of the one that taught me a lot of stuff, had done his trapping and hunting wolves and coyotes back in the 20s. He swore them down it was by moon phase.
Really?
But, you know, I never could quite make that connection. Mm-hmm. But he swore by it because the guy that taught him swore by it.
Right.
So, and that's what he knew, and that's, and I'll admit, he could kill the shit out of him, so.
Well, one of the things I wanted to talk about tonight with you specifically was vocalizations.
Mm-hmm.
So going back to what we were talking about earlier on, you know, an evening serenade, does that change throughout the year as to whether or not they do that?
I have seen times they won't answer to it.
Now, if I'm going to throw out a guess here, and I'm going to guess that the times that they won't are when they have pups in a den.
Yes, especially right after.
Right.
Once she's a day or two into having pups, everything's dead silence.
And the reason for that, theoretically, is because they don't want to give away their position because Correct. They don't want other coyotes to come in and kill their pups.
Well, that's my theory. Others have said so as well. I haven't got a straight answer out of a coyote on it yet.
They're kind of tight.
I tend to agree that way. I've asked a few, but I think that's correct.
Mm-hmm.
When those pups are that immature, it's hard for her to move them if there's a threat.
Yep.
And he's no help, really.
And that's something I've heard before too, and it was in that book I was referencing earlier as well, or one of the other books I've read, is that often coyotes may have several den sites.
Yep.
And if one of them is disturbed, they'll move to another one. They don't like activity around those den sites.
They like things nice and quiet, peaceful.
Well, sure. They want their pups to be safe.
Right. And yeah, they have no problem. If she even thinks there's something in the neighborhood that could kill her pups, she'll move them.
And I think that's common with other animals as well. For example, there's a farm by me that I've hunted, and in years past, they've had a family of fox living underneath their barn.
Right.
Well, I put a game camera on it, and I got a bunch of videos of the fox coming in out of this hole underneath their barn. But of course, this always happened when it wasn't season. I couldn't do anything about it. In Michigan, unless you have a permit from a DNR biologist, you cannot take fox out of season. And those permits are not easy to get. They're pretty tight with them. So what happened was these people sold that farm and some new people moved in. Well, the new people, she actually operates kind of a rescue. She has a bunch of different animals there. And for a while there, I figured, well, I lost the property. You know, I didn't hear anything from them. They didn't communicate with me. Well, I want to say it was probably beginning of January. All of a sudden, out of the blue, I get a text from this person. And she says, hey, I think we got something living underneath my barn. There's a whole dog there. I'm concerned about my livestock. She goes, well, I'm an animal lover, but I'm more concerned about my livestock. Would you be willing to come over and hunt this property? I understand you used to hunt it before, and I said, sure, that wouldn't be a problem. So shortly after that, I went over and called it, and I didn't see anything. And then we got some good fresh snow, and I figured I'd go over and check it out with that fresh snow and look for any sign.
Right.
Well, I went over there, and what I found was there was no fresh sign. And what I also found was they've been doing a bunch of work on that barn. They put up new barn metal on it, and they put in new pasture and this and that. So I told her, I said, there's no sign over there. And my guess is because you've been doing all that work on there, you disturbed that den site, and she probably moved to a different den site.
Yep.
And she asked, you know, well, will they be back? And I said, they may be back if it calms down enough, you know, and she feels safe there to come back again. But my guess is they probably aren't terribly far away, but they moved to a different den site because that one was disturbed.
Yeah, she'll be close by somewhere.
Yep. So that's something that, you know, I've heard from time to time about them. You know, if a den site gets disturbed, they'll move. That's why, you know, around between now and, oh, what, January, February, March, around March, April, when they start doing these dens, we've had different people in the state that all of a sudden, oh, I found a den. I'm going to put a camera on it. They put a camera on it and they don't get shit for pictures.
Yeah, they don't see nothing.
And that's because they disturbed that den site and they moved to a different den site. I think there's been one or two people that have successfully put a camera near a den site and gotten some pictures and videos, but they're pretty few and far between, and it's most likely for that reason.
Yeah, and fox, they can be tough. It's hard to move around that little den and
right.
not have them know.
Right.
They're pretty sharp.
Right. Yep. So if so this time of year during breeding season, we still are hearing serenades. Now, from a hunting perspective, what's your approach to if you go out in the evening and you're hearing serenades?
If I'm hearing serenades and I'm out in the evening, it's because I'm planning on hunting the next day.
Okay.
As a rule, they won't serenade all that close to the den.
And, okay.
I mean, to a degree they will, but if they're howling and it's just coming on dusk, just almost dark,
mm-hmm.
You kind of figure on your Google Maps, you get on there and figure out which drainage they're in. And then you slip in there where you can kind of see both ends of that drainage, 2-3 hours ahead of time.
Mm-hmm.
Don't howl back to them. You already know where they're going to be traveling,
mm-hmm.
or there's a good chance they will. Just stake it out, sniper them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and if they come wandering down through the draw, give him some lead.
Okay. So, but that being said, this time of year, what vocalizations would you use? Let's say you didn't hear serenades, but you know there's coyotes in the area.
Well, God bless Tony Tebby on this one. That den raid, pup whimpers, you know, all that breeding stuff works. If I'm during the day hunting it and they do sing back, throw out a male howl,
like a male invitational.
Yep. It's a double, you get two responses usually out of it. Seldom do you really get a hard active challenge. They'll actually come to it to face you down
quietly.
Right. The male will do it to run your ass off, and the female will do it just to see who in the hell's in the neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
Conversely, if you don't hear any serenading, but you think there's coyotes in the neighborhood, throw out the female howl. If all's quiet, but you think there's something around, you're seeing tracks, throw out that female. That's a different response. He's coming in to see if he can get a quickie,
mm-hmm.
and she's coming in to run off the floozy in the neighborhood.
Now, that's something I actually learned this year, was that the females will often scrap during breeding season.
Yes.
And I guess I didn't realize that as much, but Mike and I were out, this was probably beginning to mid-January, and we ended up calling in a pair on a new piece of property. We shot them both. I shot the male, he shot the female, and we went and got them. This female, and I got the pictures of it somewhere, had very fresh bite mark and scratch
right around her nose. Yeah.
On her nose, and then another one like on the side of her jaw, mm-hmm. that was like, I mean, it was a deep puncture wound.
Oh, they get serious. Yeah.
And it was fresh. And I actually sent that picture to Tony Tebby, and he says, oh yeah. He says, those females, they'll scrap this time of year during breeding season.
More so now than any other time of the year, I believe. This is like any other female. When she's got her home base set up, and she's got her old man married up, she's going to protect that. That's her nest.
Right.
And yeah, they'll go to blows now more so. I think the only other time will be right after the pups are born.
Yep.
If the male's not in the neighborhood to go defend them, she'll come to the hell's gate to run whatever off.
Now, see, that I could understand, and I would expect that.
Yeah.
But I guess in general, in terms of, you know, coyote scrapping, I just naively assumed the males did more of that than the females. But
oh, they do, yeah.
But it was just surprising to see that female tore up like that. I mean, it was pretty impressive. I've shot dozens of them that had scars, you know, torn ear, scar across the face, whatever. And I just attributed that to, you know, random encounters and, you know, scrapping. But I guess I didn't realize the females were that scrappy during breeding season.
Well, the worst one I think I've ever seen during breeding season was I got a female once over in the Powder River that must have got into a bobcat. And I mean, that poor dog was, oh yeah, she had to have got that bobcat down on his back because he worked her stomach over. Oh God. And blood.
Disemboweled?
What'd say?
Was she disemboweled?
Not quite.
Okay.
But it was close. I mean, if stayed in there much longer, but she still came to the call.
Oh yeah.
She was still had plenty of fight in her.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, she was pretty tore up.
Wow, that'd be pretty wild. I mean, I think one-on-one, a cat's going to mess up a coyote almost any time.
Yeah.
You get
depending on the age of the cat.
Yeah, you get a couple coyotes, though, and they might get a few licks in more so. So, invitational howls with female, if you don't hear anything around, male invitational howls, and, of course, pup distresses are always good.
Right.
Now, as you transition to that period coming up where they have dens, up until the point that they actually drop pups, would you still recommend those same vocalizations?
Well, you know, a lot of it's going to depend on what coyote's in the neighborhood on that deal. Some of them will be more ready to drop pups than others. Mm-hmm. You'll have one female drop her pups. The other one's still got a 2-week gestation ahead of her. So yep. You can try them, you know, and nothing's lost.
I've seen that several years ago. We had a landowner out here that was having coyote issues. We went out and in one night we ended up shooting. I think that night I was with Josh. We got 3 coyotes. If I remember right, 2 of them were females and the one was probably one of the bigger coyotes I've ever killed. It was right around 46, 47 pounds.
Wow.
Now both the females were pregnant. So when we skinned them out, we actually checked. My buddy Jeremy is a taxidermist and he actually wanted to do some taxidermy with the pups. So when we skinned them out, we pulled the pups and the one female, the big one had, I want to say she had 7 pups in her. They all had fur on them, almost fully furred.
Right.
Probably 6 inches long, give or take.
Uh-huh.
You know, all good size. The other female, which was smaller, I want to say she had 6 pups in her, but hers didn't even have hardly any hair on them at all yet.
Those She'd were shot, later, yeah.
Yep, those were shot the same night within probably a mile or two of each other.
Yeah.
So it was it was interesting to see the different stages they were at when mm-hmm. we took them, you know, how old those pups were. And, you know, I figure that big one with those pups having as much hair on them, she was probably getting ready to drop them pretty soon, where the other one, like you said, probably had a few weeks to go yet.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Mother Nature doesn't work on a time schedule.
No.
Like a stopwatch, you know.
It's not like they all get together and have a party and everyone gets knocked yeah. up at the same time.
Hey, it's orgy night.
Right. So then, you know, there's a lot of guys that obviously won't hunt during pup season because they want them to have their pups. They want to give them time to raise up. But that being said, we do have landowners that want them all gone. Doesn't matter yep. when, where, anything. So in an area where you're hunting like that, for the first few days, vocalizations probably aren't going to provide you much unless it's, what, something aggressive, you think?
For which condition now?
Well, let's say they just drop pups.
Well, if they just drop pups, that's when they're the toughest to call, of course, because that's when they're the quietest.
Right.
But, you know,
that'd be something where if you want, you'd probably want to get close.
Oh, yeah. That's where you want to try and locate the den
yep.
before the pups hit the floor. And then go in and set up a sniper position
Okay.
And catch that male when he's coming and going. She'll hang in that den.
Right.
With her nose up those pups, but for, I don't know.
Probably 2-3 weeks.
A week.
Yeah.
Right. Well, he's got to go out and bring home food.
Right.
So he's coming and going constantly.
Mm-hmm.
So if you can get a little elevated position on him and tag him out coming and going,
mm-hmm.
it could be tough to get up on that den, though, because he's...
Oh, they're watching it. They're watching it. That's one thing I've heard is a lot of times they'll put dens in spots where they do have a good vantage point. They can see around because they want to be able to make sure everything's safe.
Right. So as far as calls, you know, I'm reluctant to really recommend anything.
Okay.
Unless you can get way back and hit them with a pair owl.
Okay.
If they think that the neighbors are crowding their position, then they'll challenge.
Mm-hmm.
They won't necessarily howl back, but they'll challenge. And they'll both challenge.
Mm-hmm.
Once that's done, then you can pinpoint right where they're at.
Mm-hmm.
But then you still got to hike all the way in to get to that den. So
right. So then, you know, I have to say they've dropped pups for the first few weeks. The pups don't come out of the den. Their eyes aren't even open for a while yet. Then their eyes will open. They'll get a little bit bigger, but it'll still be a little while before they start coming out of the den. But obviously pup distress is going to be a game, an excellent call during that time period.
Well, actually it does. It works to a degree, more so later down the road. But if those pups are only 2-3 weeks old, your best bet is to go with rabbit, rat.
Cause they want to feed those pups.
The drive is on to feed those pups.
Okay.
That's a main priority.
So then as they get older and they start venturing out of the den, you know, they'll still stick pretty darn close to the den for what, 2 months?
Oh, sometimes even longer.
Longer?
Yeah. It's tough to call. That's one of those nature does its own thing.
Right.
But they'll use that den core site until the pups are out and kind of playing and hunting on their own.
Yeah.
So, and that can vary quite a bit.
Yeah.
So there's really no call on that. But it is what it is.
There was a time where I hunted this spot and the landowner got a hold of me and he says, hey, I got people there walking his property. He had horse trails and he would have people come up and pay to ride his horses through the trails. And he says, these people are seeing these pups out in this field all the time. And he says, they're hanging out in this like ravine. He says, but they're seeing them. He says, can you come up? So my intent was when I went up there was to set up and hopefully draw out the adults, take care of the adults. And then I could work on the young ones because they'd be too stupid to know what to do anyway, basically help them out with this problem. So I set up where he said he was seeing them. And sure enough, probably, oh, I don't know, maybe an hour before dark, here come 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 pups. And they were probably, you know, about like that big.
Yeah.
And I got video of them. I watched them. Shoot, those pups came to probably within about 10 yards of me. I got to watch them play in this field for a good half hour at least.
Right.
And it was actually really fun to watch them play. And at the same time, I'm thinking, you know, this guy wants me to get rid of them all. So like I said, I was hoping, that the adults would come out. Like I said, I could take care of the adults and then take care of the pups. The adults never came out. And eventually it was funny because a deer came out on the far side of this field and watching those pups interact with the deer and the deer interact with the pups. It was pretty funny to watch, but eventually all the pups went back into this ravine. And I'm thinking to myself, okay, well, let's see if I can call the adults out now. So I think I started off with a howl. And right off the bat, they cut loose howling down where those pups had went. So I just waited patiently. And sure enough, here comes one out.
Yep.
I dropped that one. It was a male. Those pups never did come back out. I got them to howl again in that ravine, but they never did come back out. So I actually think the landowner was a little disappointed in me that I didn't get all those pups taken care of. That being said, I've got plenty of them since then.
But,
yeah. It was kind of interesting, one, to watch them play, and two, to work a call knowing that they were in the area to see what would come out. And just the male came out, like I said, and I dispatched him. So that was kind of interesting to have that happen. I don't remember exactly what time of year that was. If I had to guess, I'd say it was like maybe June.
March, April, June.
Yeah, somewhere around there. So it was just kind of interesting that way. And then on that same property, another spot I was hunting, I went in there, and this was a video that got shared a ton. And this brings us to our next point. Once those pups get big enough, they'll start vocalizing on their own, and you'll get the mom and pup serenades and all that stuff going on.
Yep.
And going back to this property, I went in there, and I knew the coyotes were in this area. I got set down. I let out a nice long female invitational howl, and they were, I think this field that I was on was only maybe 50 yards wide, and then it dropped down into a deep ravine again. And they were down in that ravine again, and all of a sudden they just cut loose. And you could tell it was a family group. I mean, you could hear the pups in there. You could hear I'm assuming the female started it off, and then all the pups joined in. And it was actually a really cool video in terms of listening to the vocalizations. But I think one thing that I've
and
noticed,
it carried on for quite a while.
Oh yeah. Right?
Yep. Yeah. Yeah.
One thing that I have observed is it seems like you can pretty much get pups to howl by doing almost anything.
Oh, they love to sing. Yeah. Oh yeah.
And especially if you get one of the parents to cut loose, then those pups cut loose like crazy.
Yes. And it's funny because pups, you get to where you can kind of understand what the adults are saying, you know, I'm over here, or where are you? Pups, they're just blabber.
Right.
They're just making noise, you know. Right. It's like
they're just trying out their voices.
Yeah, they're just getting their lungs built, you know. They're just making noise to make noise.
Yeah. I've had it's kind of fun, you know, that early summertime hunting when you do encounter them, to sit there and watch them and listen to them. There's another spot I was hunting one day, and there's a tree line that divided two fields, and again, I knew the coyotes were out there. And just before dark, I look across the field, and there's these two coyotes. And they were young ones. They were juveniles. I think they were past the pup stage, but they weren't adults yet. And I was watching them. They're out there playing, trying to catch bugs and all that. And all of a sudden, they just sat down and started howling. And I was watching them. They were a little bit too far away for me to take a crack at them, so I just watched them for a while. But it was a lot of fun to watch them howl and play around. And that's something I think a lot of people don't know as well too, and I think you guys see this out there a lot more than we do here, even though we see it, is a lot of the pup's diet in the summertime is insects,
grasshoppers.
Yep. And I've seen that with that family of fox at that farm I was talking about. I went out there one night, and I think I had four fox kits playing around in front of me.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a blast to watch them trying to catch bugs and stuff. You know, they're jumping, trying to catch stuff flying through the air and everything else. But, you know, obviously the parents will go out and, you know, kill rodents or whatever and bring them back to eat. And then eventually they start teaching them to hunt. But a lot of their diet during that time frame is insects.
Yep. Grasshoppers, crickets, spiders, anything that crawls, lizards. I've seen a coyote pup once take on a horny toad out here. And that was the best wrestling match I've ever seen.
Oh, really?
Oh, it was just hilarious. He tossed that thing in the air and it come down, and he couldn't bite him, you know, because, you know, it's a horny toad.
Worst they could do is spray blood in his face.
Right. And it was just comical as hell to watch.
Yeah, I get, you know, around here we don't have too many lizards. There might be some snakes and stuff like that, but I would say around here a lot of it's gonna be like grasshoppers. You know, that's probably about the meatiest insect we have around here.
Right, right.
But they're pretty plentiful, especially in the tall grasses, which is where I think you see a lot of them hunt. And then obviously the moles and mice and voles and all that stuff.
You know, it's funny because a lot of people don't associate insects as food for a coyote. They just don't make that connection, you know.
But it's a very important food source for them.
Very, very important. In the summer, you can catch them actually eating millers. They'll dig around in the rocks. It's like a grizzly.
Mm-hmm.
They'll turn those rocks over and then lick the millers up. It's just, they got to eat what's available.
Well, sure. And it's high protein and it's easy.
Oh, sure.
So going back to vocalizations, how often do you use, and is there a particular time of year in particular that you will use challenge howls? Or do you only use them as a response?
I only use them as a response. My take on the challenge howl is it's really good when they're really territorial.
Mm-hmm.
Just because, and this is touches on that comment on Facebook that we've seen. A guy was asking, well, he was barking at me. So what do I do? And everybody's going, well, obviously you were seen, throw him a challenge howl. Well, no, you've already stirred him up. He doesn't know what you are. He just knows there's a predator down there. And he's kind of wondering, he'll howl and bark a little. He's waiting for you to tell him what you're up to.
Mm-hmm.
Are you raiding his fridge? Are you in getting a little nookie off his girlfriend? Are you just passing through? You know, and he's wanting the indication from you why you're there. He's let you know you're trespassing. Now, finish the story out.
Mm-hmm.
Tell him, I'm a female in heat, and boy, this buddy of mine here is going to give it to me. And that's my go-to this time of year, when they bark or howl quick like that, they aren't necessarily challenge you. They're just asking. So give them the extra chirp. Tell them you're female in heat. You'd love to meet him.
Mm-hmm. Do you prefer an e-call for that or a hand call for the estrus chirp?
You know, anymore, I'd just soon do it with an e-call because I can go right to that button.
Okay.
I got it programmed.
Mm-hmm.
I can do it with my box call. I just don't think I sound that sexy. You know, that e-call, that's tough to beat.
Right. You know, going back to the estrus chirp, there was debate for a while where some people were saying there's no such thing as an estrus chirp. I watched a couple of videos on YouTube of guys using an estrus chirp with really good success. Josh and I were hunting one of my properties and we parked on the south side of the road. And our plan was we were going to go across the road to the north side and we were going to hunt that. Well, we get out of the truck and we heard this noise and we're like, you know, what the heck is that? Look through the scanner. Sure enough, there goes a pair. And that female was doing that chirp. So, I mean, yeah. I've heard it. I know it's a real thing. One of our local guys here that did a lot for coyote hunting back in the day in terms of, you know, seminars and getting it popular and everything else. That's one thing that he really did. And he made a hand call specific for that. Todd Sullivan, a.k.a. Dog Breath. He made an estrus chirp hand call specifically for that call. I've used it from time to time. I know Tony Tebby has some from Cantley, I think the coyote's name is, and a few other ones too. I've used it before in the past with success. It's kind of a subtle sound, but my opinion and how I do vocals is I like to run a vocal and I don't always let that sound file go the whole time. I let it go for a little bit and then just sit back and wait. Give them time to respond to that. Give them time to come into it. And that method seems to work really well for me. I think if you do too much, you're almost getting the opposite effect.
Well, an estrus chirp is easy to overdo. Mm-hmm. We've all been around when the family dog's in heat and she's doing all that whining and whimpering. Coyotes aren't penned up. You know, they'll do that whimper whine thing and do a little chirping and then go on about their business. It's similar but different, you know, and you can overdo it pretty easy. Just do it maybe a minute, half minute, whatever you're comfortable with, and then give it a break.
Yeah.
And then hit it again. If you're sounding desperate, think of it as a girl at the prom. If she sounds desperate and looks desperate, nobody's going to go anywhere near her.
Right. Yeah. Makes sense. So another, I mean, that even applies to me and how I use vocalizations. Late spring, early summer is the same thing. I've had a lot of good success with letting out like one or two invitational howls, and then I'll wait sometimes as long as like 10 minutes before I let anything else out. And quite often on some of the places I hunt, I'll repeat that sequence, like say three times. Mm-hmm. So I'll let out an invitational howl, wait 10 minutes, let out another invitational howl, wait 10 minutes, let out another one. And more often than not, by the time I get to that third howl, I'll see a coyote somewhere in that field. And more often than not, he's sitting there just looking.
Yep. Checking it out.
Yep. And some of these places where I use that particular sequence are similar terrain to what you have out there, where there's a lot of grass and brush and all that. And there's been a few times where I can tell you, even during the daytime, if I wouldn't have had thermal, I might not have seen them, because I know for a fact they blend in so well with that.
Yeah.
That I'll bring the thermal out there because I might not be able to spot them as I'm getting older. Maybe it's an eyesight thing. I don't know, but I'll look with that thermal and I'm like, holy crap, there's a coyote just sitting there and he's just looking. And at that point, you know, depending on how far away they are, I'll either take my shot or I'll try and throw out something else to get them to close that distance.
Right. I tend to agree, although I don't necessarily just run it like three. If I break out with a female invitational, I'll run it twice, mm-hmm. and that's it. And then I'll give it a little break. And depending on what season we're in, I'll follow up with whatever I'm going to do next. And I'll let it play through once and then give it a break. But you're familiar with out here, the vast distance that coyote has to travel sometimes to get to you.
Mm-hmm.
He wants to hear something in his ear to keep his interest
right
over that long distance.
Yep.
And a lot of people, I'm sure, listening to this don't understand what I'm talking about. But when you can see the mountains 30 miles away,
right,
and that coyote can hear you half that distance.
Yep.
You know, it's really a wind and distance thing.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And, you know, that brings up another point, too. I mean, there's been several times where, like, I was out with Josh, and I can think of a couple in particular where we were calling, and all of a sudden this coyote appears and it's out there a ways and it's not coming to the call. It's going paralleling across it. And Josh will be like, well, get on it. Let's get on it. Let's get on it. You know, and I'm like, dude, throw something out there to get its attention to keep it coming. And I think that there's times where that is really beneficial. Like you said, it's kind of like an attention span thing. If they come into the area and then all of a sudden there's nothing there, they're going to lose interest. They might move on. Whereas you throw out something, you might get them to close that distance better.
always recite to yourself that the coyote has the reasoning ability of a 15-year-old, but the intention span of a 5-year-old.
Okay.
And to me, that's about how it works.
I've heard the attention span thing, and I think if you equate that to like bobcats and fox, I think they have the attention span of like an infant.
Yeah.
That's one thing I've definitely noticed with them, but coyotes. Yeah. Yeah, I guess I didn't know that about the reasoning ability though. That's
they'll work a puzzle out. If especially if they're approaching a predator distress, that's why they think to come downwind.
Right.
Well, if they're answering vocals, they'll charge in from any direction.
Right.
They're not thinking through that, hey, there may be something there can kick my ass.
Right.
They're just coming to the call because
they think another coyote
has got their attention. Yeah.
Yep.
That coyote's always thinking. He may not think about it too long, but he's always thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where the attention span thing falls down.
So going back to what you were talking about in terms of that gentleman on the post that was talking about, he thought he was busted. So in your experience, kind of describe what a coyote noise, what noise a coyote makes when you're actually busted.
Oh,
for people that wouldn't know.
Right. If you're truly, truly busted, if he's seen you, smelled you, and has identified who you are, you're not going to get a warning bark or a challenge. You're only going to see his butthole headed over the next hill.
Okay.
And little dust puffs coming up from where his feet
hit. Right, he's out of there.
Yeah, he's especially if he's been shot at.
Right. But let's say, for example, he didn't see you, didn't smell you, but he heard something.
Right. Then you're going to get that bark challenge thing that they do.
Which is like a series of sharp barks with maybe short a barks, short howl.
Short, very short, sharp howls. And if he's really wound up and really going to town with him, he's not listening to a word you're saying. Mm-hmm. You can throw everything at the book at him. He's busy talking.
Now that's what they would call a warning bark, correct?
That's a warning bark. Yep. That's different than a challenge.
But right.
But if you're just getting the old questionnaire challenge, you know, a howl with a couple of short barks, you know, you can play with that. He's listening. He wants to know. Yeah. And that's when you give him the excuse, okay, this is what I am. You can play that angle.
Okay.
But you start throwing challenges at him. Next thing you know, he's mad and he's talking warnings to everybody, and he ain't listening to a damn word you're saying.
Right. And that's one thing I think a lot of people, that especially people that don't understand the vocals, a lot of, from my experience, listening to the what the coyote's saying and how they're saying it will give you a lead into possibly either sex or age of that coyote.
Correct.
That will tell you a lot of how you should respond. If you have a young coyote, you don't necessarily want to use an aggressive vocal because correct, they are a young one. They don't want to get their butts kicked. Now you have a deep resonating, aggressive sounding response that could very likely be a more dominant male. Those are the ones that will pick a fight.
They're the ones that will come into scrap. Yeah.
Yep.
In fact, so much so that he sometimes will only give you one shot. He'll answer once and he's on his way.
Yep.
He's not going to talk a lot. He's just coming in to kick ass.
Well, the old common knowledge was if they're not howling, they're moving.
That's right. That's right.
That I think that's one reason why I give them so much time. If I get a response to a howl, that I just sit and wait. Or, you know, if they howl, I howl back. I give them plenty of time after I respond to come in. But yeah, it's one of those where, you know, trying to identify, if you can, the age and the sex of the coyote and their response, will gauge how you respond.
What your response will be, right?
Right.
And you know, it takes a little practice. To, it
takes a lot.
Well,
I still don't think I have it down, but I try hard.
Well, and especially even today for females, I struggle sometimes to decide what age they are. Mm-hmm. For some reason, if I hear a female answer, she may be an old one, but I hear a young one.
Yeah.
And I've never figured out why that is. But now males, I can tell you when his birthday was, you know. I can nail him. Well, that one's about 4, you know, or 5 years old. Or that one's a young pup is just getting his balls grown out, you know.
It pays to take the time to listen to your call files on your caller. You know, the call manufacturers and the call producers now are doing a better job, I think, of either giving a description of or describing in terms of what the sound file is.
Right.
Of more of what it is. Now, back in the day, and there's still a lot of them out there, just says coyote invitation. And if you take the time to listen to those sound files, you can tell by those sound files to an extent or by the description, if it's a female, a male, a young coyote, an old coyote, pup, whatever. But taking the time to learn those sound files makes it so that when you do get that response and you say, okay, that's a young female, what do I want to respond back? You're not just going to randomly pick something. Listen to those files, know what they are, and then you have a better idea.
Right. If you got a grasp on what she's telling you.
Yeah.
You know, and I can't recommend enough. The name escapes me right now. He did a bunch of videos on YouTube explaining what different call howls and yips and whatever is. I can't think what the hell his name is.
Was it a call maker or?
Yeah, he has one of those TV shows that old fella out of Nebraska. God,
Randy Anderson?
Randy, yeah. He did one for something outdoors. I should have looked it up before I got on here, but he has a whole series of where he goes through and he teaches these guys what each call sound is saying.
Mm-hmm.
And it's worth your time and effort for whoever's listening to this to get on YouTube and search that down. It'll take you a couple, 2-3 hours, you know, to really grasp it.
Mm-hmm.
And listen to it a couple times, you know, but that'll help you more than anything on your calling abilities.
So I got a question for you. And this has actually been on my mind a lot when I've been out in the field lately, especially this month. I've called in and killed my bobcat, but I have yet to take a shot at a coyote this month, or actually January. I have yet to shoot at a coyote in January. Part of it is I haven't been able to get out because I went to SHOT Show and then I was sick and blah, 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 and focused on bobcats. But like we hunted this tournament last weekend and it was the slowest weekend I've had for coyote hunting in I can't even imagine how long. We hunted all weekend as much as I could. I think we seen maybe 4 or 5 coyotes. None of them wanted anything to do with the call. And we had vocals, I think, twice the whole weekend, and they were all a long ways off. So here's my question, though, is, and I could be overthinking this, but you can tell me what your opinion is. Every coyote vocal is unique, okay?
Yes.
Like, for example, Tony Tebbe has Canty the coyote. If you look at Rick Pallette, he has, you know, Sook. He has Star. Mm-hmm. If you look at Heath Baker and Predator Tactics, they have cardinal howls, you know, specific coyotes. Do you think that they will pick up on the same voice?
That's more, and this is just my take on it. When they're doing a rally, getting the family together, yes, that's when recognizing the other sound coming in works for a coyote. Now, if you're just passing through, a transient coyote, they don't care. You know, I mean, to them, you can sound like Donald Duck.
So if it's resident coyotes and they keep hearing Steve howl, they're going to be like, yeah, hey, Steve is here again. Let's just hang out.
Yeah, every time Steve howls, I get shot at.
Right.
There's something not right here.
Right. I just wonder about that. You know, that's another reason why I like to have a good variety of calls and be able to mix them up, because I don't like playing the same thing over and over because of that fear that they're going to get used to that sound, whether or not they've been shot at or not.
Well, and that's where the mouth call really comes into its own.
Right.
I know a lot of people, that's all they'll use is their damn electronic. And if it's a highly pressured area, that hand call's worth its weight in gold.
Oh, yeah. Either diaphragm or hand call, either one, because it's going to be unique.
Yeah.
I mean, every time you use it, it's going to sound different, unless you're really, 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 really precise on how you use it. It's going to sound different every time.
As far as invitationals, everybody has their own, of course, that they've recorded and got on their call.
Mm-hmm.
I have found, at least to my experience, if your call will play two sounds at once, match those two different company calls together for invitational.
Really?
Makes sense. And it changes. Yeah. You know, and it's
something different.
I don't know why, but it works like fishing lure. It's just great.
Makes sense. I mean,
it changes things enough.
My Fox Pro can do that, and I do that quite often, but I haven't done it. I've done it with pup distress, mixing a couple of them together, but I haven't really done it very much with howls, but that might be a good idea to try that. The other thing I can do on the Fox Pro is change the pitch of the sound.
Mm-hmm.
So there's been several times where, again, I've done it with distress, but I have done it with some vocalizations where I wanted to try and make that sound like a younger coyote. So I'll up the pitch on it.
That's a good play, you know, because that young coyote, nobody's afraid of him.
Right. He's a punk.
You know, he's a punk. and they'll come to him. Yeah, quicker than an old male or female for that matter.
Right. You know, it's going back to what I was just talking about. I had one of the guys that taught me a lot about trapping and coyote calling when I first got started. He never played vocals. I mean, he didn't even play a lot of pup distress. He was strictly a play the rabbit kind of guy.
Mm-hmm.
But that being said, he helped me get my first several coyotes, both daytime and nighttime. And one thing I've noticed going to more vocalizations is I think I get better reactions out of it. But it's like the growing aspect, you know, learning more about trying different calls, doing different strategies, different times of year, has just been kind of a
learning curve.
Yeah, the learning curve to it. You know, I mean,
yeah.
I'll tell a lot of people, I said, it took me almost 4 years before I killed my first coyote. And I don't blame that, even though back then, I mean, my first set of calls was a set of, I think, Lohmann open reed.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
no, Lohmann closed reed calls.
Yeah.
And then my first call that I ever had was a little, I think it was Cass Creek, had like six calls on it and had a 50-foot cable that went to a speaker about the size of a softball.
Right.
I don't blame it on the call. I blame it on, you know, my setup, my approach, the wind, playing all that. But just that whole learning curve, that's why recently I had someone get a hold of me that said they were having trouble with coyotes. And so I called them back and, you know, tried to get the scoop on what was going on. And this person was like, well, I really don't want someone to hunt them. I want someone to come out and teach me how to do it. And
yeah,
I don't mind. In my mind, I'd rather teach someone how to do it and do it right and see them be successful than have them go through that learning curve and just make a whole bunch of smart coyotes in an area that I potentially might hunt. So I don't have a problem helping people be successful for that reason. But at the same time, I'm like, man, it took me a long time to get to where I can consistently, you know, be successful. And to have someone just say, I'll just come out, you know, a couple weekends and teach me how to do it. I'm like, it ain't going to happen that fast.
No,
you know, it just, it's not, you don't have a short learning curve to it. I mean, between social media and YouTube and everything that's out there now, you can shorten that learning curve substantially. If you invest the money, you can be more successful at nighttime. But I like to tell people, get to where you can be successful in the day on public land, and everything else will be a whole lot easier. Because if you can be successful on public land in the day, you can call coyotes almost anywhere, almost anytime. That's my opinion.
I tend to agree with you.
And I think that's a struggle for a lot of people because everyone wants instant gratification nowadays.
Well, and it's odd because a lot of guys try to watch videos on YouTube. And you can, those guys kill coyotes.
Right.
I mean, there's,
they're like, that looks easy.
It looks easy. Hey, look at that.
Right.
If you've done this for a while,
right,
you look at them and go, good God, if I tried that, that coyote would have busted me 900 yards ago.
Right.
You know, especially out here.
Yeah.
In Wyoming, it's, you know, it amazes me how many people kill coyotes in spite of themselves. It really is. It's yeah. Absolutely amazing.
Yeah.
You can make some of the dumbest mistakes in the world and still kill a coyote.
Sure.
But you haven't put all the odds in your favor that you right. could have.
Right.
You may have killed one or two there in that set, but how many did you miss?
Right.
Didn't even see.
Right. And that's something that I think the first wake up call for me in that, it was a particular set. It was a wintertime set and it was daytime and I had to park my truck. I had to walk a ways through a field, go through about a 75 yard patch of woods to the next field, which is where I expected the coyotes to come in. So I go up over there and I set up and I start calling. I think I was running just to stress at that time. And all of a sudden behind me where I walked through, I heard like one bark.
Yep.
And I'm like, you know, it was just starting to get dark too, enough to where I couldn't see through those woods. And of course, me being a newbie, I heard that. And right away, I'm like, oh, great. I'm going to get bit from the behind or something here. And never did see anything. So then I walked back to my truck at the end of the set. And as I walked back, I got to where my tracks hit that wood edge and a coyote had come down that back wood edge, downwind side.
Yep.
But see where it got to my tracks. Boom, turn around, gone. And you know, like you said, that's part of the learning curve on both learning how to set up, but also it was a wake up call for me that, okay, I need to be able, when the wind is this direction, I could be ninja'd. I like to use ninja'd rather than backdoored. I could be ninja'd from this area. So next time I need to set up. So part of the learning curve is, you know, your approach, your setup and following the wind, but also how all that applies to the geography of where you're hunting. I recently seen a guy comment, and I'd never heard this one before, but it makes a lot of sense. And now that I think about it, I've seen it. This person, and I think he was actually referencing someone else saying it. He said, look at a piece of land and where the water runs is where the coyotes are going to come through. So like if you have a washout, a lot of times they'll follow that washout.
Yeah, the easiest path, yeah.
Right. And that I have one spot in particular that has a lot of that type of stuff in it. And when I thought back on it, that makes a lot of sense. When I think of the coyotes that have come in there, that's oftentimes what they've done. It was funny because I have success out at that spot every year. It's one of my honey holes. I can usually kill several coyotes out there every year, no problem. And when I first started hunting with Josh, I said, okay, I'm going to take you to my honey hole. I said, but I'm going to tell you right now, these coyotes out here will ninja you. And you can see probably let's say 1,000 yards, both directions, mm-hmm. usually set up roughly about in the middle of it, but you can see about 1,000 yards and it's about 500 yards to the far tree line. And I said, you can watch this whole area, not see a thing, and you'll find a coyote right in front of you. And he kind of looked at me funny and all that. And I said, trust me, it's going to happen. So we set up and we called that spot. And sure enough, we're sitting there, all of a sudden, boom, there's a coyote 50 yards right in front of us. And he made the shot on it. And he's like, where did that thing come from?
Right.
And I said, I told you, they do that to you out here. Well, once you walk down there to where we collected that coyote, you've seen it. There's washouts in there. There's these little drainages and all that. And that's what they do, is they follow that. You don't see them until they come up out of that to look at the caller.
Right.
And, you know, so like I said, a lot of the learning curve too, on top of everything else, is how all that applies to the terrain you're hunting.
We use that theory. I've never actually heard it said quite that way. Out here, we try to catch in the mornings, first thing, that coyote will be coming off a lowland creek bottom. And they'll head into the hills during the summer months anyway, to get up and lay up in the shade. Our technique here is you find where all the little feeder draws lead into a big one, and that big one heads up into the hills.
Mm-hmm.
What you want to do is set up at the head of that on the high ground and catch them as they're coming up off the bottom.
Okay.
And that's, there won't be any water, and hasn't been since August because we're that high desert, but that's the route they travel.
So now what about the opposite, when they want to get in that morning sun and warm up?
Generally, they're headed back down before dark.
Okay.
In the morning sun, they're already planning with their fur coat on that it's going to be 80 or 90 degrees by 9 o'clock. They're hunting for shade.
What about in the wintertime? You think that's still the same?
In the wintertime, it's essentially the same, except they don't stick down in the bottom so much. What they'll do is they'll come out of the creek bottom, if that's down where they're hunting, and they're going to work their way up the top of the ridge instead of down in the bottom.
Okay.
That way they can see down both sides looking for rabbits.
Mm-hmm.
Where versus summertime, he's down there, he's got a full belly, he just wants to get up there and lay up for the day, have a siesta, maybe a margarita, and you know, lay around, scratch fleas. So he hangs in that bottom and takes his time and wanders up. In the wintertime, you can easily just find them on the flat or work in those ridges. And that's what makes them double tough to hunt here in the winter. You know, they change their plans all the time.
Oh, sure. Yeah. It seems like, you know, that's another one that you've heard a lot, is every time you think you haven't figured out, they do something that throws you off.
Yeah. Yeah. They write another page in the book.
Right. So going back to vocals again.
Yes.
When do you like to use fight sounds?
Fight. I love fight sounds. From the start of breeding, plumb through to, I probably run fight sounds as late as September, sometimes October. A lot of it will depend on the scenario. If you've got like deer season, a gut pile, and you know that gut pile's there, back off 3/4 of a mile or so, play that fight sound, and it's amazing how many you can draw off that gut pile to come watch the fight. It's fun. It's just because, boy, when they come in, they're coming in.
Mm-hmm.
Same way with dendrite. And when they charge in, or pup distress, sometimes they'll hit into the shooting area on a dead run. And it's hard to get them shut down to shoot at. But
there's a good example of that I had with that guy I was talking about earlier, that taught me a lot. And after I kind of got my feet under me, so to speak, in calling, we went to a new spot he had where the landowner said the coyotes were like 50 feet from his front door. He says, get out here and get them. So we went out, we set up, the property had a tree line, and then it went to a corner. So it was an L-shaped tree line, and then the open area was a field that went up, and then there was a tree line on the far side of it that was at an elevated point, probably 300 yards out, and then off to the side over that went to an orchard. So we set up down in the bottom so we could see all that. And so he asked me to call it, wanted to see how I'd do. So I put the caller out there and we started calling, and it wasn't too long, all of a sudden we see two coyotes and they're just sitting up on that tree line up there. And I was running rabbit, of course, at the time. And we're watching these two coyotes, and the one just sat down. The other one was standing up, and it would pace back and forth a little bit. And then that one sat down. And I'm like, well, the heck with this. I turned on pup distress, and those coyotes came hauling across that field so fast it wasn't even funny. And this was a late winter, early spring time frame. They came hauling butt across there. He shot his. I missed mine. That one he ended up shooting was a pregnant female, but he told me after that set, he says, man, I wouldn't have been that aggressive. I said, but it worked. You know, I mean, that's the thing. It's one of those things where you just, you know, nothing else was working. So throw something else out there.
Yeah. Try it. Hell, you ain't out nothing.
Right. The worst it could do is they walk away.
Yeah. Now on a scenario like that, I would have maybe tried it a little different. You'd already done your one female howl, right?
No, I didn't do any howls prior to that.
It was no howls at all?
All rabbit.
See, I probably would have opened with a female howl. The way I would have played it was one howl. Let them come out. Sit down, do their thing. Play your rabbit like you did. And then introduce a challenge. Like somebody's challenging the coyote that's eating that rabbit.
Okay.
And then start your fight. That those two sitting on the hill thinks, hey, somebody's down there, killed a rabbit, and now they're getting their ass whipped because the bigger coyote's stealing the rabbit. And that'll bring them in too.
Okay. In an area like that where they could see us or see the call, do you ever use one of those coyote decoys?
You know, I haven't really used decoy much. I have one, that little stuffed one that I've got. But usually the only time of the year I use that is after the pups drop and they're super defensive of their territory.
Mm-hmm.
I'll set that little decoy up in plain sight out in front, even further than the call.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll let it do its thing that way. A lot of people have good luck with those decoys. I just have never used them much.
I've never used one either. I know that guy that I was talking about earlier, he's used them a couple times. I think like once or twice he said he had success with them, but I mean, not really enough that you're like, oh, I'm gonna take the decoy today because we're gonna score. You know, I don't think I've heard too many people that have that much confidence in them.
Well, I think their productiveness is kind of a short window. Mm-hmm. In the coyote world. Certain times of the year, if they see that decoy sitting out there, they aren't coming in. They'll see the decoy, especially if he's a transient coyote.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I could see where it could hurt you as well as help you.
Mm-hmm.
But, and that, I just never messed with it because I'm cheap.
Right. And not only that, it's more stuff to carry out in the field.
Right. You know me, I'm a minimalist.
Right.
I have a rifle, my ammo, my call, my hand call, and my poncho. And that's it.
So here's another question for you. When you are running a call sequence, how important is it to you to tell a story with your calls? The reason I ask is because, I mean, everyone has their own calling style, obviously. And I remember when I first started calling, you know, one of the things says, one of the guys told me, I like to tell a story with my call. So he was very specific on the sequence of what sounds he would use at different times through his call sequence. He wanted to tell a story with that. Is that something that you do as well?
I do. Now, whether the coyote believes the story or if it's just in my head that there's a story there,
right,
I couldn't tell you. But if I can lay out a scenario, I'll do it.
Okay.
But I want to make it as believable for that particular section of the season as I can. You know, not every time of year does the estrus chirp work.
Right.
You know, so you want to play your sequences out. If you want to make up a story, fine. It keeps you entertained. Whether it entertains you, who knows?
Yep. I mean, you know, going back to what you said earlier about, you know, some people just go out there and blast a bunch of stuff. And yeah, sometimes they'll be successful. And other times you'll paint a picture as pretty as Picasso and nothing happens. You know, it's just
right.
It's hard to say. You know, that's one thing you see a lot on the forums is what sequence is working right now. Well, you know, I change mine up every single time I go out, so I can't give a straight answer per se on that.
Yeah, there really is no right answer. People will tell you what's working for them.
Right.
But that isn't going to work on every coyote, and especially not year-round.
Yep. Now, here's another theory of mine, and you can tell me if I'm full of crap if you think I am, but...
Well, I already know you are.
I'm not afraid to admit it. That's why I talk to people no more than me.
Yeah.
I think that when you look at what is going on with coyotes, like, for example, right now, breeding season, I think that over here in Michigan, we are actually about 2 weeks out from what you guys are seeing in the West. And I think that also applies to like West and South. And I think that applies primarily because of the weather differences. Do you think that theory is viable or do you think I'm full of crap?
No, I think you're right. Mice, from just what little research and study and I've done, Canada, their coyotes go into heat even earlier than ours do. And ours go in quicker than the ones down by Arizona.
Okay.
I think what triggers the estrus cycle in a coyote has a lot to do less with weather and more about how much sun they're seeing in a daytime, during the day. I'm still looking for biological proof of this, but,
right.
You know, the further east you go, I'm not really sure because out your guys' way, coyotes are an invasive species. You guys haven't had them nearly as long as we have.
Right.
So the jury may be out on that. Although you guys up there were in your neck of the woods, I think have had a few coyotes from Canada and the Great Lakes area and some have always drifted around, but you've never had them in the numbers, I don't think.
No.
You do now.
That guy I was talking about earlier, he said he could remember when the first coyote ever was trapped up in one of our areas. And he said it was in the early 80s.
Sounds about right.
He said, you know, they used to have fox like crazy. Because he put himself through college with trapping back when you could actually make money off it. But he can remember when the very first coyote was ever trapped up in that area. And like I said, it was, I think he said around early to mid 80s. I know that the first time I ever heard coyotes was during deer season one time. And this was probably, I had to be at least 16 because I drove up there to our deer camp on my own. I'd never seen a coyote. I'd never heard a coyote. But I went up and I was a little bit late getting up there, and I didn't want to drive back all the way to the property and screw up everyone else's deer set. So I set up outside of the property watching the swamp, hoping to catch a deer coming down through the swamp, and a pack lit up between me and the property, and I heard him running the pines there. That was the first time I ever heard a coyote. And that, so let's see, if I was 16, that would have been around, I was born in 71. So if I was 16, that would have been around 86, give or take.
You were born till 71.
Yeah, I was born in 71.
Damn, I feel old.
And even then, you know, it was a long time after that, that I didn't even start hunting predators for a while after that. And it was quite a while from then till the next time I actually heard or seen one. And even now, I mean, the predator population continues to grow around here. The antis will tell you that's because we're shooting them and makes them reproduce more. But I think that's just a load of malarkey, as we talked about earlier. But still, like you guys out there, and I know you hear it a lot from like Tony Tebbe, New Mexico, and those guys down there, Nevada, a lot of those guys say, you know, you can drive from your house into town and you'll see coyotes wandering around. I can probably count the number of times I've seen a coyote while I've been out driving or deer hunting on one hand. I don't see them during the day that much. And, you know, I mean, it's gotten to where you see it more, but I mean, I know deer hunting, I've seen coyotes 3 times when I've been deer hunting. And just driving down the road, like I said, maybe another 2-3 times, not much. I don't see them around here a lot.
Of course, you guys got a lot of timbered areas.
We do. There's a lot of cover around here for them.
Right.
And
seeing out here, we used to do all our haying and stuff in the fall. Coyotes be coming out of the hills around us in our hay meadows while we're cutting and baling hay, picking up mice.
Yep.
I remember that as just a little kid.
I've heard that from the farmers around here. As a matter of fact, a couple of the property owners have told me, hey, I was out cutting hay and we got coyotes playing in the field, come get them. But, you know, one thing you notice around here anyway, if you go further east in the state, and especially like southeast part of our state, there's a lot of more agriculture, a lot more of that open ground. I'm close to the lake and we have a lot of woods. So like farmers' fields like that are more secluded. So I'm not driving by those a lot.
Right.
I know one of the times that I remember specifically seeing a coyote in the daytime driving around, I was driving past, it was probably about a 5-acre field and they had just cut hay, and I was driving by and I look, boom, there's a coyote standing in the middle of these fresh cut hay rows. So right off the bat, I went to make sure I had permission to hunt that property, and then went right out there and called it. And I actually had a blast and I never fired a shot. It's like I said, a 5-acre hay field surrounded by woods. And I sat down right in the middle of it and started running the collar. And I had, I think it was 3 pups running circles around me. And the mother was standing over on the tree line, just barking her head off at me, telling those pups to get back.
Yep, to her. Get back, get back.
Yep. And it was funny because I didn't shoot at any of those pups. And that female just bark, 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 bark. She barked the whole time. Finally, I got up and walked back to my truck and she was still barking the whole way back. Oh,
yeah. You had her stirred up.
Oh, yeah. And I did go back and I ended up killing coyotes out of that field. But that particular day, I didn't. It was just a blast to watch them run a circle around me, you know. It was pretty cool. But yeah, it's a lot of fun for sure.
But you see them quite a bit during the day out here. You hear them a lot more than you see them actually out here
in the daytime.
Middle of the day. Yeah, in the middle of the day they'll howl out here.
See, now around here I very rarely will you hear them in the middle of the day.
Oh yeah,
I know we've had them howl first and last light is real common, and then through the night. But midday, I can't remember hardly ever hearing them vocalize midday.
Well, you remember Coyote Canyon. That was daylight.
That was nuts. All those coyotes howling, and I never seen one. They sounded like they were right there in front of me, and I couldn't see them.
Yeah, they're right there. I told you they were right there.
I know. It was just crazy to hear them and what sounded like they were real close and not be able to see them.
Yeah, there must have been 6 or 7 of them.
Right.
Just right there in that little draw we were at.
Yep. That was crazy. We'll have to try that again next time we come out there.
Yeah, I want to get down in that at the tail end of it, work our way up and hunt that.
Mm-hmm.
I've never done it yet. Usually I can raise at least 4 or 5 different howls out of that drainage, you know, and they're right there. I think that's part of a corridor area. Yeah.
You know, it makes sense based on the geography for sure.
Yeah. Me and you need to get in on that, work that, see if we can smoke them out.
So here's another question for you. You've obviously you've hunted with a lot of other people out there in your area.
Not a lot.
Not a lot. Well, I know you've had myself and Joe out there. You've had George out there. John Collins comes out there. Have you ever noticed a difference on how people call based on where they're from?
You know, I've noticed that a lot more on YouTube, watching you guys do your night hunts.
Mm-hmm.
The calling's a different style. I mean, it's not wrong.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there is no real wrong or right. Just the styles,
yep,
a little different. I've noticed kind of that you guys don't do nearly the locating that we do out here, mainly because out here there's such a large area that we have to.
Mm-hmm.
But that I see that pretty prevalent. And the speed, which you guys are night hunting and you're not hid, you're standing up in the middle of a field, but the speed at which you guys are calling is more, hunting a contest.
You mean like you're talking about like stand time or frequency of the calls? Well,
yeah. Stand time. If we go out and set up, we may sit there half an hour before we ever even turn the collar off. Just let things settle down.
Mm-hmm.
None of you guys do that. You hike out there, you set your gun and your tripod up, and you carry your call out, set it down, you march back, get your collar remote out, and go to work.
I've seen that discussed just recently. I think it was O'Neill Ops was talking about it on how they like to let an area settle like that. There are sometimes, primarily during the daytime, where I'll do that. One of my favorite sets during summertime, or, you know, when it's not cold and frigid like it is now, is I like to get out there, let's say like an hour before dark.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll just sit I wait until the last half an hour before dark, and then I'll start calling. I actually really enjoy doing that type of setup. But at night I don't ever do that. I mean, unless I'm breaking ice getting out there, once I get out there, like you said, I get up there, set my collar, get back. I might wait a minute or two just to scan and see if there's anything else out there. But right, other than that, I'm starting my calls pretty quick.
Well, a lot of times here, we always work the back side of a ridge. If our little 2-track road is running kind of up in elevation, we'll park and just walk over the ridge. The pickup's only 30 yards behind us, but it's out of sight, and call down into a drainage. We don't necessarily wait at that time. And then we'll just pick up, drive up a little further, another quarter mile, and do it again. And I don't see you guys hunt and call that way much, but
we don't have many ridges.
Well, yeah.
A lot of our ground is pretty flat. Now, in comparison, what we do have, though, like I mentioned earlier, is patches of woods that open up into fields. So, you know, when we go out, at least where I'm at, what I'll do is I'll say, okay, I want to get back to this field back here. So I'll park my truck over here, walk through a patch of woods to get to that field. That's about the closest we have to something like that. And, you know, that's one of those where if it's summertime, I'm not going to make a whole lot of noise getting back there. In the fall, when the leaves are down and they're dry and crunchy, you'll make a lot of noise getting back there. Or like right now, we're at the stage in Michigan now where we got a bunch of snow and then it thawed and then it froze again. So we have a layer of ice out there. And of course that makes a bunch of noise. So in situations like that, other than like when we were hunting that tournament, you're going to make some noise getting back there. So I'll give it a little bit of time to quiet down sometimes.
Now, you guys just got hit with a big storm, didn't you? Last couple of days?
Down on the southern part of the state we did, where I'm at, we didn't get it.
Oh, okay. So you weren't really affected by it too much.
What we had is we had probably close to 2 feet of snow, and then we had, I think it was one, maybe 2 days where it got up close to 40. So a lot of it melted, and then it dropped back down to where we're in the teens again. So all that froze. So we have that hard crust on top of the snow right now. We did get a dusting of light snow today. So there's just enough that I can't see the ice.
Tracking snow, yeah.
Yeah, so there's just enough to see that and not see the ice that I slip and fall on because the snow covered it. But yeah, other than that, you know, unless you're in a farmer's field that has a drainage ditch or something like that, most of the ground around here is pretty flat.
Yeah. You guys are like a land of a thousand lakes, something like that.
I believe it is. They say in Michigan, you can't go further than, what is it, like a mile and a half without running into some body of water.
See, that's the exact opposite of what we got out here.
It might be a small stream or something, but I don't think you can go more than like a mile, mile and a half without running into some sort of water.
That'd be a definite hunting challenge.
It can be for sure.
I'm in terror. Yeah, I'd be out of my element. Out here, a body of water is just as likely to be a border for a coyote as a fence line or anything else. And that's where they build their home territories. Out there, I don't know. With that amount of water around, your guy would hunt that.
It's what I'm used to, so I don't know.
Well, yeah, like out here, you bring you guys out. I warn you about the cactus. You know,
yeah, but you waited till I sat in one before you warned me. I think
you and you both.
I would say around here, what we look for is, I mean, obviously there's plenty of water sources around, so we don't have to worry about that too much. What we look for more is those edge areas, you know, the edges of fields.
Transition areas.
Yeah, transition areas. Fence lines a little bit, but to be honest with you, we don't have a lot of fences out here either. The biggest fences you have around here, unless someone has livestock, are orchards. Because now they've gone to, because of the deer problem, they'll put in fences tall enough to keep the deer out around orchards. Most of those fences have openings in them big enough for a predator to slip through, but they're tall enough that the deer don't want to jump them. So gotcha. They have to fence those areas in to keep the deer from destroying the orchard. That's about the closest you have to fence lines around here, unless someone has livestock. So again, you're looking for transition areas, washouts. This time of year in the winter time, creek bottoms are really good travel areas because those creeks will freeze and those become predator highways.
Same here.
Yep. And then
river bottom.
Yep. And then we're also looking for, we do have a lot of swamps out here. So we look at where that transition is from swamps to like hardwoods or swamps to a field.
Now, George was telling me, too, that you guys, he catches coyotes out on the lake cleaning up fish guts.
Yes. It's actually something I've heard quite a bit. Because ice fishing is a really big thing up here. And I've talked to several people that have been out. Matter of fact, there was just a video posted. Gosh, I want to say it was maybe a week or 2 weeks ago where some people were out ice fishing and a fox came up and was eating the fish that was on the ice while they were fishing. So now I don't know if you know who he is, but Robert Patrick.
I'm not familiar with him.
He does rare earth calls. He's a hand call maker.
Oh yeah.
He makes some really nice hand calls. One thing he talks about a lot is, especially during mating season, they will use like the frozen lakes or frozen lake edges for easy transportation. Because you figure every other time of the year, they have to go all the way around that. Mating season, they're traveling a lot. So that becomes an easy travel route for them, is to cross those frozen lakes. Usually once or twice a year, someone will post pictures even of either fox or coyotes out on Lake Michigan in the icebergs. Towards the shore of the lake, until that freezes, the water, you know, we get a lot of wave action, so it creates these icebergs. And you, like I said, usually once or twice a year, you'll see someone post a picture of either a fox or a coyote out on those icebergs, even on Lake Michigan. It's pretty crazy, because the first time I thought about it, I'm like, why on earth would a predator be out there on the ice? There's no food for them. So why the heck would it be out there? And that's one thing that Robert Patrick talks about. And I think Ed Gajewski talked about too, is that becomes an easy travel corridor for them.
Sure. Absolutely.
And that's why we feel that the wolves have migrated from the Upper Peninsula to the Lower Peninsula, is because that stretch between the two will freeze. Once that freezes, matter of fact, I've seen pictures of guys that will snowmobile that, and they'll have wolves running across as they're driving across that on snowmobiles. They'll see wolves transitioning back and forth. And they have confirmed some wolves down in this Lower Peninsula, and we feel that's probably how they transitioned over here, was they just came across when it froze over.
It actually might be a good thing. You get some wolves down there eating those poodles.
I completely agree with you.
And that'll change how they vote.
I completely agree. Yeah.
I give a taste of what they've been, you know, fighting for.
Right. Yeah. What those people in the UP are dealing with.
Yep.
You know, there's movement on that. Just this past week, Safari Club International actually sent a letter to our DNR recommending a wolf management plan with a hunt, which is nice to see a big organization stepping in and, you know, putting that out there, trying to get them to have it, because the people up there definitely want it. And, you know, it's a lot of people up there like to espouse the three S's. And I understand that with what they're dealing with. I mean, you have, let's say you have a group of dogs that you love to run rabbits with, or birds or bears, and your dogs are getting killed by wolves, or your livestock's getting killed by wolves. I get that. But at the same time, I want to be able to legally harvest one, because I want to save the fur. I want to save a skull or what have you.
Right.
So I hope that the pressure is enough that they have a season. They've been talking about the potential of having a season this year. We'll see if it happens or not. Depends on whether or not they cave to the antis.
So it boils down to, we're still fighting to get our grizzlies delisted.
They're still protected, huh?
Well, Wyoming, Idaho, and Montana just joined forces and devised a plan. Of course, the antis, you know, blew their top again. Mm-hmm. So they're going to challenge it in court, but we'll see if it goes through. It's, you know, it's just an ongoing battle with these things.
Right.
Well, we'll see how it plays out.
That's one thing I talked to several people when I was out there in Las Vegas at SHOT Show, were some of these areas like California where they've banned trapping or hunting with some of these animals. And now they're becoming a problem, specifically like mountain lions. They say now they're getting mountain lions in town because there's no control over them. There's getting to be more and more of them. They're not pressured. So they're moving into towns and coming after people's pets and what have you. And
right.
They're like, you know, it's especially in Nevada, the people were saying, you know, in Las Vegas, you have a bunch of liberals. They're the ones that put this stuff into effect. Everyone outside of Las Vegas is like, no, this is getting to be a problem. We need to get, you know, a management plan going again.
Right.
So, yeah, it's a constant struggle for sure.
Well, did you have any other calling questions?
No, I think that's good for tonight.
I don't know if I answered them all, but, you know, I guess they can message me. Somebody can if they'd like. On Facebook, I'll answer whatever questions I can. I love helping folks, you know, even the new guys coming in. I can't be a wealth of information on night hunting because we do mostly day out here. But, you know, old stupid tricks. I know a lot of those.
And we appreciate it. We appreciate it.
I know it's a little late now, but I should have been on here earlier telling everybody to save their New Year's hooters, you know, the squeakers.
Oh.
Those are a great game call or a predator call. You know, and stupid stuff like that. A lot of people have forgot over the ages.
Yeah.
But hopefully we help somebody tonight.
I hope so too. It was a good conversation. I appreciate you joining us.
Yeah, it's fun. I enjoy it.
Yeah. So if anyone wants to get a hold of him, his name is Buck Wells. You can look him up on Facebook. I know he's on quite a few of the predator hunting groups, or you can go directly to his page. Feel free to shoot him a message. And once again, we enjoy having you on here. Thank you.
Well, thanks, Kevin.
All right. Have a good evening.
And hope to see you next hunting season.
I am hoping for that as well.
Keep your fingers crossed. The draws are coming.
Will do. Thanks, Buck.
Yeah, see you.